I remember I was in my D course and one of the coaches there got in trouble because, so US Soccer has this software program that you have to use to like set up your sessions. And for whatever reason, he mixed up the fact that like your team has to be like blue squares and the defenders have to be red circles. And he got it mixed up and he got in big trouble for that. And I'm thinking to myself, what are we talking about here? Like what, how is that even remotely important to what we're doing here? Like, okay, he messed that up. Let's move on.
Hello everybody. Welcome to another episode of the 343 podcast. This is where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today's topic is a good one, a vibrant one. I think this is one of our better episodes ever. And sincerely speaking, we're going to be talking with Rory O'Neill. He has a YouTube channel that is very popular in the soccer space. He's a longtime coach, a successful coach. And we go way back, at least digitally, with Rory for quite some time now through 343 itself. We talk about licenses in this episode. And for the coaches out there, I know you have a lot of experiences with licenses, whether you've done the D, the C, the B, the A, maybe you've done some overseas stuff. And there's a recurring theme or controversy or debate here in American soccer as to whether these licenses are worth it or not. What are they actually good for? Should you do them? Should you not? And from my personal perspective, I've not been shy to kind of crap on licenses and say that they are definitely not the value add that they claim to be. And parents, I think it's important for you to be aware of the discussion that's happening out there in the ecosystem, because you're out there in the marketplace and probably looking at coaching resumes at times and you're like, ooh, this guy has a B license or this guy has a C license. And that might be influencing your decisions, and it probably shouldn't be influencing your decisions. But we get down into the weeds with Rory here. He's very articulate on the matter. He's very experienced. I asked him to come on the show to share a lot of his views and his insights. Speaking of licenses and my opinion of them, we have an alternative for you, or at least we have the component that is the educational component versus the credential that is a license. And you can find that at 343coaching.com. Coaches, we have free and premium products for you there. Whether you are a first-year coach, a second-year coach, a fifth-year coach, and in many instances, we've had coaches with 20 years experience emailing me saying, Gary, oh my God, like this has revolutionized my coaching. I never knew all this sort of stuff. Thank you so much. So guys, it's of huge value no matter where you happen to be on the pecking order, from the beginning to the end at all levels. Parents, we've developed something for you as well. It is at 343masterclass.com. The objective there is to try to elevate your level of discernment in the soccer world such that you can mentor and guide your kids in a much better fashion. It is no coincidence that the sons or daughters of former professional players or the sons and daughters of former soccer players who are very experienced get far in the ecosystem. And yes, some of it can be attributed to nepotism, but much of it actually is because those folks can really mentor and guide their kids quite well. So I'm trying to close that gap as best as possible through the masterclass. So I'll repeat, 343masterclass.com is where parents you want to go. And then lastly, if you're coaching the little ones in the 7v7 format, you can go to 7v7coaching.com. All right, here we go with Rory O'Neill, and we're talking U.S. soccer licenses. Awesome, I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm good, man. I had like this electrical issue at my house. That's why I was like not sure I was going to be able to get on with you right away, but I fixed it. So I'm doing good, man. Spring season just got started. How about you? What's new in your world?
Yeah, same old, same old. If we're talking soccer, the highs and lows of soccer per usual, you get some victories and you get some defeats, and that could be on the field or off the field and business and et cetera. And you just have to roll with the punches.
Man, isn't that the case? Yeah, there's no doubt. I was in a tournament this weekend with one of my U11 teams, and they played fantastic. Really like dominated the semifinal game, and we made one mistake in the back, ends up tying the game. Because they're trying to play out of the back. They're great kids. And we go to PKs in the semis and lose 5-4. So what do you do, you know?
Isn't that how it always goes, Rory? So, I mean, I can't even remember how many times that's happened to us. In fact, this past weekend, I don't know if you're aware that Brian got a pro coaching gig here in USL. And
no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so you've heard of USL League One, right? So it's basically the second tier of USL. So there's the USL Championship and there's USL League One, and it's a professional tier. And it's over here in Antelope Valley, here in Southern California, and it's a brand new franchise. So from the get-go, you know, you have to build it from scratch. I'm sure there's a lot of challenges associated with that. But long story short, he had his debut game away this past weekend, and they lost 2-0. And as a matter of fact, I think it was within the first 15 minutes. I was only able to catch the second half, but in the first 15 minutes, they're trying to build out of the back, and the goalkeeper just like has a shocker of a moment and basically has the ball stolen away from him, and 1-0, you know, the other team. So obviously the dynamics changed from that point forward. But yeah, like you said, everybody's learning, and building out of the back doesn't come without its risks.
Correct. Yes. No, that's 100%. I mean, I think De Zerbi said he doesn't like to take risks. That's why he builds out of the back. But I think that there's quite a lot of risk building out of the back, especially when you're talking about youth, the youth game. You know, it is what it is, right?
Yeah. Hey, thanks for doing this, man. I really appreciate it. I've been meaning to reach out to you for a while. I don't remember when it was, maybe 3-4. No, probably maybe 10 episodes back when I was talking to Benny and the topic of licensing came up. One of the first people that come to mind is professionals in like the medical industry, because I think that needs to be pretty heavily regulated. And obviously it's important because of public safety, you know, patient safety, all those sorts of things. And so I know that you're in the medical profession, Rory, so, and in soccer, obviously. So it's kind of the convergence of two worlds. And I thought it would be a good idea for the audience to hear a little bit about the licensing side of the equation. So I don't know if you're coming into this conversation with any thoughts already, but if you want me to jump in the driver's seat, I can do that. We always just try to free flow everything. My initial thought is maybe you can, because not everybody knows you from my audience, sincerely. So maybe you can just start off briefly mentioning, you know, what your profession is, what you do for the day job, so to speak, and then maybe how you got into soccer, and then we could just talk about licenses after that.
Yeah, definitely. No, I am an emergency medicine physician by trade, and I got into soccer coaching about 14 years ago. That was through my kids, and now I sort of gone from coaching 3-year-olds playing indoor with walls up like a hockey rink to I've coached for the Philadelphia Union's pre-academy. I now coach in MLS Next in the pre-MLS Next type of team. But really, most people know me from my YouTube channel, and that channel basically got started really as just a way for me to communicate with players and kind of share ideas, and it blossomed into this. I don't really understand the YouTube algorithm. Maybe you could help me with this, Gary. The last video I posted was just a dumb reaction video to like what US soccer is doing with their age changes. And it's like blowing up. And I don't have any idea why that's happening. But it is. So if you've got any insight in the YouTube algorithm, I certainly don't. But yeah, as far as and I'm sort of with you. I'm kind of just taking this as we go. But I was thinking a little bit about licensing because I do have a unique perspective from the medical licensure side of things, and then I've also gone through both sides, the U.S. licensure. I'm up to my USC. I actually was going to be in the USBs, but I had to pull out in January because I got another team put on my plate. And then I've gotten the UEFA pathway all the way up to the UEFA B. So I have my UEFA B and my USC, and I'm happy to compare and contrast those two as well. From a medical licensure standpoint, the only thing I want to start with, because I know what's going to happen, Gary, is a lot of people listening to this, the first thing they're going to hear is you're comparing a medical license to a coaching license, and they're going to roll their eyes and they're, you know, and I want to just put this out there first. There clearly is a difference as far as, you know, standards, as you said, in terms of a bar to kind of cross or get over from a medical licensure standpoint, that comes with safety, that comes with prescribing medication, that comes with things like that. That being said, there are also parallels that I think you can really turn to and look at when it comes to how you get a license to practice medicine versus how you get a coaching license, because it's a very different process entirely.
Got it. Now, and I don't want to bias your view. I don't think I will, because you're your own man, obviously, and you're going to speak your mind irrespective of my opinion. From my perspective, my vantage point, I see it as quite different in the sense, as like I kind of foreshadowed already, you know, a public safety, a matter of public interest in the former versus not so much in the latter. And so from my viewpoint, it's like, yeah, you know, I think you want to introduce everybody who hasn't coached soccer before and give them a little bit of guidance, a little bit of structure, a little bit of a trampoline to jump into what coaching is, just so that maybe they don't do all that much damage or harm, if you will. For example, maybe give them the concussion protocol, maybe give them some sort of ideas of what is a proper warm-up for certain ages, especially at the youngest of ages, okay, where they're most vulnerable. Maybe give them a look at what is proper versus improper training, you know, at a certain age, things of that nature, and then go off, young scribe, into the wild and learn your coaching trade or your learning profession. It seems from beyond that, and we can dive as deep as you'd like. Beyond that, for me, with my experience here in this ecosystem, it seems like USSF, US Soccer / MLS has I don't want to say weaponized, that's not the right word, but kind of used the licensing thing as a way of gatekeeping as to who they want to be coaching in a particular echelon of the pyramid versus who they do not want. And who they do, who they don't want, that's a subject unto itself. And same thing, just apart from coaching individuals, clubs as well. What clubs get to participate in certain competitions versus what clubs don't get to. They use this licensing thing as a way of gatekeeping once more. So that's kind of like the bad side of the equation, you know, but I could always steal, man, and say all the good positive things that can come from licensing. But again, I want to allow you to free flow more than myself.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I think is most striking about just when you look at, like, so I'm in Pennsylvania, and for the state of Pennsylvania, or the Commonwealth, as they call it, to grant me a medical license, I actually have to bring quite a bit to the table for that. Like I have to show that I graduated from an accredited medical school. I have to show that I finished an accredited residency in whatever specialty I have. I have to show that I passed certain board exams. I have to show that I've done a certain number of surgical procedures, if that's applicable. Like, I have to bring a mountain of things for them to even begin the process. You know, because not only, I mean, each state actually has some of its own requirements. So Pennsylvania makes me have a certain number of hours in child abuse education. I have to have a certain number of continuing medical education requirements per my board specialty. I have to have a criminal record, no criminal record. If I was arrested in the last 3 years for anything, they make you go through drug testing. I mean, I could go on and on. If you look at how most licensures, I'll stick with US for a moment when I talk about coaching licensures, the only thing you really need to bring to the table is the prior license. So for example, if I want to get my B license, I would have had to have my C license for a year. Now, there are a couple exceptions to that, mostly around playing experience, which that's a whole other, I think, rabbit hole we could go down, as far as, you know, what role playing experience actually has in determining whether you should get a coaching license or bypass a coaching license, let's just say. But for the most part, I don't really have to bring anything to the table other than the prior license. Now, the UEFA pathway, and I think the U.S. System is changing this a little bit. The UEFA pathway, I actually have to have a certain number of continuing coaching education credits per 3-year cycle to keep it. So that's a little bit better. But when it comes to just like, what do I need to get into this class? Unless you're talking about the USA license, which you actually have to apply to, from the B down, you're just bringing whatever license you had before. I mean, there's no real bar that you have to cross. I mean, there's nothing that you have to show, say, hey, I've done this, 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 and this. So now I need to be licensed. So it just gets to what you were saying, is that because you have this license doesn't necessarily, like, if you go to a gastroenterologist who's licensed to practice in Pennsylvania, there's always going to be good physicians, you know, better ones, all that. But there is a certain thing, there are certain things you can be guaranteed of. They went to medical school, passed and finished medical school. They went to a residency, passed and finished the residency. They've done a certain number of colonoscopies or whatever it might be. And the Pennsylvania has said, okay, and that's the other thing too. When I first got my licenses, and again, I think US is changing this, you had it for life. Like, if Pennsylvania, you know, if they grant me a license to practice, it's for 3 years. And then I have to reapply because I would have had to keep up with those requirements. So just when I think about the differences, just broad based, that's one big thing that kind of jumps out at me, is that I don't really have to bring much to the table to get into a license or to be a part of a license. So what value is that license? You know, I mean, if you go to all these websites of clubs, or, you know, the first thing people put on like LinkedIn, it's like, I have a D license, I have a C, I have a B. But what does it really mean? It's not the same as a medical license.
No, it's a good point there. So in other words, if I may paraphrase, anybody can go through the whole chain of licensing. All you have to do is pay the fee, get into the class, do the course requirements, and insofar as maybe going to the B or the A, okay, you had to have had the previous license for a year at least, or something like that. So all that really would show me is, okay, you're kind of dedicated to jumping through these hoops and doing what it is that they tell you to do to pass the course and get the certificate. And that's about it. So, I mean, I liken it sometimes to getting a degree at times. And I know every degree is a little bit different, whether you're in STEM or non-STEM and these sorts of things. But for the most part, you know, a bachelor's degree demonstrates to a potential employer, hey, you are willing to eat, you know, all this workload for at least 4 years, usually, although it seems to be more nowadays. But you had some base level of commitment and responsibility to get through the quote unquote pain. Now, who comes out the other side? Like you mentioned, there's a bell curve. You could be atrocious, you could be exceptional, or you could be in the middle part of the curve and be, you know, mediocre, if I may say that. Yeah. So question, because you said you had your C. I've heard many stories up until recently, even, that there's quite a bit of demand to get in. And you have to apply and you have to be approved or enrolled because they only have a limited number of spots now. So there's two things involved there. Why the limit in supply? And, you know, we can talk about supply side, supply and demand economics and making it more rare for people to have a C or a B or an A license. So you restrict the supply of those licenses. And then obviously the gatekeeping of just, you know, accepting the people that you want to accept and rejecting people from the course that you want to reject. So I don't know if you had that experience at all where it's like, oh no, sorry, Rory, thank you for applying. You know, we've maximized our enrollment. Please try again in 6 months. And have you heard of such a thing? And is it necessary? Because you did your C. Is it necessary? Could they have had more quote unquote students in the course?
So I know the answer that they give when that criticism comes up. I don't know if it's true or not. They will tell you they don't have enough instructors. That's what they will say. They will say, you know, we don't have enough instructors. So, you know, we can only have, you know, one instructor per, let's say, 12 coaches. So if we have three instructors, the course is only open to 36, coaches. I mean, the courses fill up at least right now, the way that they do it is it's a January start or a July start for the major ones, for the A, the B, and the C. They do for the D and the grassroots ones more of a calendar-based type thing. But from a standpoint of, so what happens is it's very interesting because sometimes I'll get an email and sometimes I won't, where it'll say, hey, the B license is open. Go ahead and sign up for the wait list. And then sometimes I'll just randomly go on to US Soccer's website and it'll say, hey, you can join a wait list or you can, you know. And so what happens in general is they reach a certain number. And then, yes, I've been rejected for many. So this changed for the B license very recently, a year or two ago. It used to be for an A or a B, you had to apply. And the way that you applied is US Soccer on their website, they've got like a profile and you have to upload, you know, all your coaching experience, if you got other, you know, courses from somewhere else. And then you basically could just hit apply for whatever course. And I was rejected twice for my USB license before they opened it up. And actually that was the reason I went to the UEFA route, because I had applied to my USB license. And I knew kind of where I wanted my coaching career to go. And I know I was going to need either a B or an A to kind of get to the higher levels. And I think what Europe is recognizing is there's a market here. I mean, they're not stupid either. I mean, it's expensive to get your UEFA licenses too. They're seeing, I mean, when I did my UEFA C license, half the coaches were American. And they do kind of batch the international, you know, candidates, as they call them. But the disadvantage here, I know what you're going to say. I don't see any disadvantage of having thousands of A license coaches in the country. Like I don't see a disadvantage. The disadvantage would be to gatekeepers and people who want to restrict certain jobs, because then they have an artificial way of saying, well, we're only, you know, to even apply for this job, you need an A license, let's just say. But I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's Iceland that has the most A and B licenses per capita in the world. And I don't know this for, but I'm pretty sure it's fairly like inexpensive to get your license there. Here, that's a totally different game. And maybe that's a different conversation that you want to wait on. But just in terms of if I've been restricted from licenses, yeah, absolutely. And I don't know why they do it other than, to your point, to kind of, you know, create this supply and demand. And you know, some of the guys that I know have had their A license, they've had it for 30 years. Like they got it in the 80s or the 70s or the 90s, and they haven't done a thing to improve themselves since, but they're an A license coach. So.
Right. I like exploring down this path a lot because in my opinion, it really isn't discussed as much in the mainstream. And I think, you know, what our angle has always been, or I'll say my angle has always been, is kind of jabbing at the establishment, poking holes in the establishment, and then others can ask questions, right? And be a little bit smarter about what it is that's happening in the United States. It's interesting that your initial attempts of getting in twice now, right? I think I heard, you know, you weren't able to get in. It seems to me, of course, I don't have quantifiable information, just anecdotal. It seems to me that if you happen to be a coach coaching in a particular club or tier of club, let us say, like an MLS franchise or things of that status in the hierarchy, then the chances of you getting into the licensure increases significantly. I haven't really heard of a coach being rejected if they have been coaching for the Philadelphia Union or, you know, Inter Miami or the FC Dallas, right? They're actually part of the MLS franchise itself versus clubs that are let's call them, I don't know, no-name clubs or mid-tier clubs or clubs that are in ECNL or clubs that aren't even in ECNL. It seems to be much more difficult for those coaches to get a shot at being enrolled. And so what ends up happening, in my opinion, if that's true, which I believe it is, you create this virtuous cycle for the folks in the top tiers of the hierarchy, and you create a vicious cycle or a glass ceiling or a caste system for those who aren't in that strata or in the establishment itself, which really sucks. So now the incentive is obviously if you want to be a big time coach, you kind of have to forgive me, Lori, but you have to be a bootlicker of the establishment and then try to weasel your way in that way. So it kind of sucks because it develops this incentive structure where nobody can, there's not a competition of ideas, if you will. They've created this monolith.
100%. I mean, you know, when it comes to my experience with colleagues of mine who have either been rejected from licenses or got into licenses, one big differentiator that I feel like, and again, I don't have quantifiable data on this either. I think there's a big difference if you're just in the youth game versus if you are in the college game. I had a lot of friends of mine who were college coaches, either assistant coaches, head coaches, who didn't seem to have as much pushback as I did from getting into certain licenses. And I hate to say this, but I have found that especially if you're in the women's game, it can be a little bit harder than right. If you are in the men's game. And maybe that's just my own perception, but I have a lot of friends who are in the women's game quite high in some respects. And I found that their path has sometimes been harder than some of the guys who are either kind of coaching down that D3, D2 men's kind of pathway. And I don't know, again, what would be the harm. It's interesting too, because you think of the guys who probably need these licenses the most, are they the ones coaching the youth or are they the ones coaching college? I mean, you know, the ones who need as much help as they possibly can, to me, would be the youth coaches. Right. And so, yeah, you have that sort of dichotomy as well.
No, and the guys that are not in the professionalized environment of these MLS franchises. If you're a coach who's privileged to be at that level with that organization, that institution in and of itself can supply you the education, quote unquote, the education that you need.
Right.
They can send you overseas if they want to do the French course or do whatever it is that the club deems is important for their coaching staff versus the low level, low tier clubs, in quotes again. They don't have an institution that can do that sort of thing. So it would behoove me, I would think, that US Soccer would be like, hey, we should prioritize the guys not in the big institutions and give them the first crack at enrollment.
Well, it's funny too, because when you think about the costs of the courses, the people who would be most, because a lot of my friends do work in MLS academy situations, they have many opportunities where the club will either pay for the license in full, in part, they'll help them out. I mean, if you're coaching at a local club, most local clubs are not going to be able to spend thousands of dollars for their coaches to go and get a license. So, you know, you have that disadvantage too. I mean, again, the people who probably have the most resources to actually get this done are the ones who, to your point, the self-fulfilling prophecy, where they are the ones who actually get in the courses.
No, it's unfortunate, man, because I've always been about forming a meritocracy. And this is a barrier to forming that meritocracy, which I believe in many respects, in sports in particular, it should be among the most meritocratic things out there. From the athlete side and perhaps even the coaching side. And it's just broken, in my opinion, because of the licensing structure, which is why I wanted to have you aboard, Rory. So let's talk about costs a little bit more, because I'm a little bit out of the loop from the youth game. I know that the earliest of licenses, I think there's something before the D, if I remember correctly, like that one and the D or... might be free. I don't even know anymore, but I know the C costs substantial amount of money. Maybe it's on the order of $2,000. Maybe you can give me a little bit of insight, or us, the audience, a little bit of insight as to the cost of these different licenses and how long quote unquote of a course is it? Is it like a one session thing? Is it a 6 month thing? Just give a little color to that.
So the way that, you know, one of the other problems is that this changes every 3 to 4 years for whatever reason. When I first, this would be 15 years ago or so, I got my, they had an F license, which was literally, I think it was $25 and it was all online. After the F license, I went to the E license, which also doesn't exist anymore. And that was like one weekend where I had to go to a club and kind of learn. And I don't think I actually really ran a session, but it was more kind of like a classroom scenario. And that was a couple hundred dollars. The D license is typically two, like either weekends or 3 to 4 day stints. And it's several months. It's in the order of $1,000 in that range. Once you get to the C license, now you're talking $2,000 to $3,000. And that doesn't necessarily include, so like here's the thing, I live in Pennsylvania. If I can't get into a course that's close to me, but I can get into a course in Florida, now I have to pay to fly to Florida, and so the C license I actually took. So that actually, I'm just remembering this. So my C license I actually took in Ohio because there was no room in Pennsylvania, but there was a spot in Ohio. So I was able to drive, 5 hours, but, so there's the cost of just the travel in general, but the C license, now, again, you're getting into the $2,000 to $3,000 range. Once you get to the B license, you're now in the $5,000 range. And the A license is even more. So, you know, those are really high, barriers to entry, obviously. And it's just a lot of people will just be completely turned off by that. And then the question you have to ask yourself is like, what are you getting in return for that money? Because I think much like this idea of pay to play, like I think most consumers in general, whether it be soccer, like they'll pay for something if they're getting value out of it. So what am I getting from my B license that would be worth $4,000 to $5,000? I mean, and that's pretty similar to the UEFA course. I spent around $4,000 or $5,000, and I had to take a plane to Scotland for that. So it was worth it to me because of where my career trajectory. I knew I wanted to coach MLS next at the highest level, and maybe something beyond that. So for me, that was clearly valuable. But if you're just coaching, to your, you know, what you said before, a very good or a middle of the road or whatever ECNL team or club, what real benefit would it be to you to get, you know, to spend all this money to get a license?
Yeah. Everything I hear from you also, and correct me if I'm wrong, is something that I believe this is all about. It's credentialism. From a value perspective, what value am I getting? If I'm going to pay $5,000, it seems to me that most people are doing that to have the credential so that then they can pass that credential around and get recognized for it and get employed for it. But I don't hear many folks saying, oh my God, the B license changed my coaching life from a pure knowledge, expertise, leveling up perspective. Would you agree with those statements? I always want to look on the bright side at times. I know there is value. I know there's good content that might be shared in these courses. I know there might be a few gold nuggets that help coaches out and see a perspective they never thought of before. But is it worth $5,000?
No, it's not worth $5,000. However, there are definitely positive parts of every course I've ever taken. Like I've gotten something that I've, you know, used now in my toolbox of coaching. So one of the things that I think about or that I've thought about in the past when it comes to licensure is the difference between the US license and the UEFA license. I really think that there's some analogies to non-STEM versus STEM. Like the US coaching licenses are not, in my opinion, particularly detailed. So there's a lot of kind of, you know, this is how you would set up a training session. And like they do things like, you have to write down the who, the what, the why, the where, you know, like things that to me are kind of fluff, if I'm being fair. The UEFA class is very, like, you can follow it logically. So for example, the UEFA C license, everything is based on the 4-3-3 formation. So they talk about attacking in the wide areas, defending in the wide areas, attacking in the central areas, defending in the central areas, all out of this just sort of, you know, kind of premise of a 4-3-3. And so everything you're doing from a session standpoint, when you run the session, like your coaching points, and soccer is obviously not like math. So my coaching points or how I view how you're going to attack in the wide areas in a 4-3-3 might be different than the way you think. So there's that flexibility, but you have some relative framework. And the US license wasn't like that. It was way more nebulous. I'm not saying I didn't get good things out of it, but they would say, okay, you're running a session where you're attacking in your defensive third. So like a building out of the back session, something like that. But it was really like, okay, so now you're going to run an 8-4 building out of the back, but like it didn't get to the details. Like the UEFA class, you had to basically, one of the things that happens in these coaching courses, not to go on any other different tangent, but that just came to my mind, is you kind of have to show it. So like you get out there and you've got 25 other coaches watching you run a session, you can tell pretty quickly if somebody's not prepared, if somebody like doesn't know what they're talking about, if they're just trying to wing it, and the UEFA guys were much more, hey, listen, like, what's your coaching point here? What are you doing here? Like, what is this? Like it was to the T. Whereas the US soccer, like I wasn't really given a ton of feedback other than good job or you pass or I would have really liked a lot more specific feedback. And again, I know that part of it might have just been the instructors and all that stuff, but my UEFA sort of journey, which is really why, I mean, I got the B UEFA license because I know where my career wanted to go, but I definitely did the UEFA B license first because of my UEFA C experience. And so the UEFA B license, they expand it. So now it's not just a 4-3-3, it's a 3-5-2. It's a 4-4-2 and it's a 4-2-3-1. So you have these four basic formations, and now we're going to base everything we do on that. And it just made a lot of sense in terms of, okay, here's, you know, just a logical progression of how we're going to actually approach the game with the idea that different coaches kind of do things a little bit differently. And maybe the way I want to, you know, defend centrally out of a 4-4-2 might be different than the way somebody else does, but you can't really fake it. Like you can't really just say, oh, just play guys. Whereas the US courses, I didn't really feel like I had to get to that level of detail.
No, it makes perfect sense. I don't know if I can add much to that at all, aside from that has been my anecdotal experience, not from taking the courses, but from knowing, I don't know, several dozen coaches pretty closely who have done similar pathways, and they share the same thing. Here it's in the US, it seems to be a lot fluffier, a lot more, there's no right or wrong answer sort of thing. And, you know, I don't want to get you in trouble in any respects, but maybe you can comment a little bit about instructor quality. Myself, my background, as you know, I teach physics, and from the teaching profession, it seems to me that the guys, the professors who can flow without really looking at notes and really are open to and encourage a lot of questioning, right, or questions, they encourage it, like, give it to me, guys. Ask me whatever you want because you're so confident that you have a depth and richness of knowledge that you can address just about every question because you've heard it all before and you've seen it and done it so many times. And anecdotally, again, it seems like the USF instructors aren't like that. It seems like there's a lot more rigidity, and it seems like they just want the students to kind of comply and accept what's being given to them and then regurgitate exactly what's given to them, and then you'll pass. And it seems like, again, that the students are implicitly incentivized to just go along with the program, wink, wink, and we'll just pass you. And then let's move on from this. Like, It's very transactional. It's not very much a expert giving expert advice and guidance.
Yeah, I think transactional is a really important word that you brought up, because I remember I was in my D course and one of the coaches there got in trouble because, so US Soccer has this software program that you have to use to like set up your sessions. And for whatever reason, he mixed up the fact that like your team has to be like blue squares and the defenders have to be red circles, and he got it mixed up and he got in big trouble for that. And I'm thinking to myself, what are we talking about here? Like what, how is that even remotely important to what we're doing here? Like, okay, he messed that up. Let's move on. It's interesting because I've had some good US coaches in my session, in my licenses, but I don't know how much of it is just the process versus the people. Because so to just go back to my UEFA class, I did that through the Scottish FA. The guys who do that, that's their full-time job, is educating coaches. Yeah. That's all they do. They don't have another profession outside the game. They don't, I mean, I think maybe they help with like some of the pro clubs and do some other things coaching wise, but they run coaching courses every single week. I mean, it's a full-time job for them. The guys in the US was not their full-time job. I mean, they had, you know, other either jobs through the specific state. So when I went to do my C license, the guy who did that was like, I think the technical director for the Ohio Youth Soccer Association. So I know that they take it very, very seriously. And I'm not naive. It's clearly a business too. I get that. But from just the guys who are running it, I mean, the other thing, and I don't know if this is a Scottish thing, they did not hold back. I mean, like they were not, they were very nice, but if they thought you were like screwing up, they'll tell you. That like they like have, you know, which I honestly appreciated. Like I thought, I don't know. I think most of the coaches appreciated that. Like if we're not doing something, you know, that you think is wrong, let us know. Versus a lot of times the US licenses that I've gone through, you either don't find out until you get your grade back that they didn't like something. I mean, the Scottish guys, they'll stop you. They'll like, if you're running a session, they'll be like, wait, stop. What are you doing here? What is this? In the US world, they usually just kind of let you do your thing. At least my experience has been, they let you run your session and then they kind of just let it be at that. So I don't know. I almost, now that I'm talking about this, I don't know if it's just the way the system is set up, because I did have some good instructors in my US classes. I don't know if it was the system and the way that it was set up that kind of led to maybe, it's just so nebulous. Like when even running a session, like you don't necessarily know what you're supposed to do from a detail standpoint.
Got it. It's so interesting that you mentioned that they're full-time instructors over there and that's all that they do in many instances, because I have this view, there's always this tension between experience, actually doing the thing that you're teaching versus not having that experience, if that makes sense. So, I mean, I've been advocating since 2009 online, through the 343 stuff that, hey man, if you're going to learn from somebody, make sure that somebody has proof of work of what they're advocating for, right? Like, do they have an extensive video library of their actual teams playing the actual football that they are saying should be played, right? And do they have maybe actual video footage or evidence of them training their actual players, right? And then you get to witness how they engage and interact with the players themselves, those sorts of things. At the same time, I can appreciate that you may not have to have that to be a good teacher or a good instructor and to deploy good knowledge, if that makes sense. And obviously the best of both worlds is if you have experience in both things. And I say all this because, again, from anecdotal testimony, folks, and maybe they just had bad experiences, folks say that here in the States, it's like they had instructors who they've seen them coach their teams, you know, throughout the years, and their teams play, for instance, kickball, and it's a disaster, and they give terrible instruction from the sidelines. And next thing you know, they're U.S. soccer instructors giving courses in the B license or in the A license or in the C license. So it's kind of a head scratcher from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I can, and I don't know exactly how they pick the guys from the Scottish FA to run it, but the vast majority of them had pretty extensive coaching resumes from, you know, professional clubs in Scotland. I mean, most of them had coached for 20 to 30 years. I mean, they were older. They had coached some of them in the Scottish Premier League. You know, some of them had coached in lower divisions. I didn't get the sense that they were like career coaching, you know, licensed people. But, you know, there's definitely going to be that variation, I think. And I suppose there probably is, you know, politics to everything as far as who gets what job and things like that. But my general experience from the UEFA side to the US side was really, it just was so much clearer. I mean, it really was like a STEM versus non-STEM. I mean, like, it just made so much more sense to me as somebody who, you know, was really thirsty to learn. And I think a lot of these coaches go in, like, I went into my US courses, like, thinking I would get a ton out of it from a soccer perspective. I'm like, all right, I'm gonna learn really specific, you know, soccer tactics, session planning. And it was really more periphery stuff that didn't get to the actual details. And I almost had to like kind of teach myself. I mean, obviously I'm a 3-4-3 member, but I did deep dives into a bunch of other things. And then, you know, I think I mentioned this before. Part of being, I think, a really successful coach is failing a bunch and grinding and, you know, finding out what works and what doesn't. And I don't know how to quantify that piece of it, but the license doesn't get that. Like, there's no license that can make up for, you know, I've been doing this for 14 years now. You there's no license that's going to replicate that.
Yeah. Even though, but that's what it seems to be. That's the signal that they're trying to sell to the marketplace. If you have these particular licenses, they try to correlate it with quality of coaching, which is sometimes really triggering for me and frankly, triggering for a lot of colleagues who may be D as in Delta licensed coaches or C, right, as in Charlie licensed coaches who, for one reason or another, can't get the next higher license because of the reasons that we spoke about earlier, the economics of it all, the value exchange of it all, or, you know, the gatekeeping side of it all. But having said that, Rory, another question, if you don't mind, is if there's no licensing hierarchy, how do I phrase this? Maybe we'll just say it straight up. Can the market kind of sift through the coaches and the coaches will find their level, if that makes sense?
That's really funny. We're on the same page here, because I was just going to ask you if you had any insight on how this works in Argentina. Because, you know, to answer the question you just gave me, no, there is no way to really, unless you have a certain background, discern what is good coaching and what isn't. Because we have no meritocracy, as we've just talked about. There's no way for, you know, me to take my team and go up to some level that will get me recognized. Now, maybe my team plays a certain way and people, you know, appreciate it. And that's all fine and good. But when you don't have the economic system in place to reward that level of coaching, which we don't have here, you get into this scenario where, like, you just the license, and maybe that's what the licensors are trying to do. They're trying to take advantage of this system where there's no real objective way of figuring out who's a good coach, because there's no promotion and relegation in any respects, in the youth game, in the pro game. I'd be curious, maybe you know, maybe you don't know, like, if you're a good coach in Argentina and you take a club up a division or two, that I suspect gets recognized regardless of what license you have from Comedy Bowl or not.
No, yeah, 100%. I don't live there. Obviously, I've never coached there. I can't give a definitive answer. But I mean, again, anecdotally, I've read countless stories, not just from South America, but obviously Europe is more prominent even at the professional level. Coaches taking lower division teams and getting them promoted once or twice or three times in a row. And next thing you know, they are top tier Division One footballing coaches, even though they never had a name for themselves. They never played for Bayern Munich first, you know, and were afforded right. that benefit of the doubt and given a job. So the most recent thing that comes off the top of my head is because I had one player playing in Portugal at a no-name club named Vizela. And Vizela was a third division club about 5 years ago. And the head coach at the time, he got two consecutive promotions. He got promoted to the second tier, and then he got promoted to the first tier. And when he got promoted to the first tier, that's when we moved one of our players to play for him. His name is Pacheco. And Pacheco never had he's a nobody, a no-name guy, right? But the very fact that he was able to accomplish that really made a name for himself, not just in Portugal, but internationally. And his current job is in playing, you know, coaching one of the top five teams in Portugal. So there's obviously Sporting, Benfica, and Porto are the top three, the preeminent top three. And then there's Braga and Vitória Guimarães. And he got the gift for Vitória Guimarães, a no-name coach, Rory. But there's a pathway to actually prove yourself. And folks here want to try and claim that, oh no, Gary, but the same applies here, even though we don't have promotion relegation, just, you know, do really well and kick ass and win the championship and somebody will. But again, you're relying on a gatekeeper to rubber stamp you and elevate you versus your own worth and your own value that you bring to the table. And it's even worse at the youth level, if you ask me, because there is no reason why we shouldn't have a meritocracy at the youth level, promotion relegation at the youth level. There is no excuse of, oh, well, Gary, these billionaires, you know, invested hundreds of millions of dollars, like for what? For the threat of relegation? Well, nobody's investing hundreds of millions or billions of dollars at the youth level. So if a team happens to get relegated from MLS Next to ECNL One and ECNL One to ECRL or whatever, I don't even know how the tiers work anymore, Rory. There is no massive economic damage and somebody's investment is going down the drain. So the only rationale that I see why there is no promotion relegation at the youth level here is precisely because they want to consolidate power and they want to control everything and that and henceforth the licensing stuff. If you'll allow me one more minute, because you brought this to my mind, Brian, obviously, you know, our audience obviously knows who that is and got to coach at Chivas USA, you know, the academy there, and got to coach at the LA Galaxy, the academy there, without having been a professional MLS player himself, which usually that is, could be considered kind of a pathway or the pathway to getting those gigs. And he got there in many respects because there was promotion relegation back when he started through the Coast Soccer League here, which was the preeminent league in Southern California and would always win the national championships, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, up until 2007 when the Development Academy started. And he went through the whole pro rel sequence and got to win a national championship. And then from there, they kind of, Chivas USA, the director at the time, identified, hey man, I want this guy to coach in our academy. So it's like a success story of having an open market and an open ecosystem. And at that time, I think Brian, you know, was kind of reluctant, you'll have to talk to him, to do the whole licensing stuff, right? For in my opinion, I don't want to put words in his mouth, kind of a waste of time and money. I think he had a D license, D as in Delta, when he got hired by Chivas USA. And when he went to the Galaxy, he may have had, maybe he had a C. I don't know, maybe, right? And then through the organization, you know, he was enabled to do the B and then obviously the A. But it's just, and like him, I think there are a number of coaches out here in the United States where that could be them also. And that is in many respects who I'm fighting for, aside from the players themselves, to try to crack this nut, even though it seems hopeless at times, Rory, to crack this nut and open the market.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with that. And there are a lot of really good coaches in the country. There really are. But to your point, with the system that's set up, I don't know how keyed in you are to the youth game, but MLS Next just announced that they're going to have a second tier. So, you know, the question would be, why would they do that? Well, they're directly trying to compete with ECNL. And so now, you know, they want to control as much as possible the youth teams. So, you know, players who, you know, for better or worse, want to play in the quote best league in the country are going to, their choices are extremely limited. They're extremely limited. And the only real criteria of getting into this league is being selected by somebody at MLS. It's nothing that they did on the field as a coach, as a player, as anybody to justify that. And again, it goes into this, you know, not that we're getting too metaphorical here, but it goes into this whole environment of why we're not competing at the highest levels with our national team. You know, we don't have the same standards for our players, for our coaches, for our leagues. That they don't have that level of pressure across the board. And so, you know, how can you possibly grow like that? I mean, if this happened in Argentina, there would be a complete, you know, upheaval, but the coaches wouldn't last. Like, they wouldn't survive. Same with the players. The same thing happens with the players. I mean, I've been over there. You know, it doesn't work. You either, you know, fight or die. I mean, and that's just not how it works here on any level.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that hypothetical of what if it was like this in Argentina. We have kind of a case study in Mexico, because Mexico got rid of promotion relegation, you know, whenever it was, 7 years ago or five, I can't pinpoint it. And there has been a noticeable erosion in the quality of the Mexican player, a noticeable erosion in the quality of the Mexican club teams, and in the quality of the Mexican national team. That, look, it's hard, and correlation versus causation is always difficult, but there's a case study to be had there, because Frank, they suck, Rory. They're terrible. Yeah. Now the MLS Liga MX teams are, you know, lose to MLS teams now at times. And believe me, it's not because MLS has made outrageous strides. I think there has been marginal improvement in the quality of MLS teams. I think that is true. But there has been a massive erosion, in my opinion, from the Mexican side. And so now they've kind of met in the middle, and it's like a toss-up. I mean, I think the Liga MX teams are still marginally better, but it's not like it was 10 years ago or 7 years ago where, you know, they would wipe the floor with the Americans. And let's not even speak about the national team. Mexico is in complete disarray, and the U.S. is their daddy. But that just goes to show how strong our country is economically, and how strong our country is from a base of players, and how strong the country is from a soccer perspective. We're so huge, and numbers are so large, and we care so much about athletics in this country that naturally, without doing anything remarkable, we're going to get better over time. And that is why the women's kick ass too, is the rest of the world didn't give two craps about the women's game, and just America being America, that was enough to win.
Yeah, no, and of course that's changing now too, with the women kind of, getting caught up with, you know, Spain and some of these other countries. And to go back to your Mexico point, I've never seen a Mexican team this poor, not in my lifetime, and that's not good for us. let me right. Just say that right now, that's not good for us, because of course with the now kind of saturization of what it takes to get into a World Cup, it's almost impossible for us not to make a World Cup anymore. And so if we don't have, you know, anybody but, let's say, Canada as a remote threat to us, how are we possibly, like some of the baked in success of South American European teams is just their competition and what they have to actually go through to get there. I mean, how does Italy not make two World Cups? I mean, Italy's Italy, you know, because the gauntlet they have to go through. And so when they get into a tournament like that, the level of experience and sort of, you know, battle tested, you know, that they are, we don't have it. So anytime, and I don't know, I a lot of my coaching friends think I'm quite the pessimist, but I just see no, I just see no road to us ever beating a quality team in a World Cup. I see no road. I mean, anytime we go up against anyone who have any level of quality, we just look so poor.
Yeah. Well, it's now or never in 2026.
Yeah.
I mean, you're home, because if you look historically at the home teams, I know this, like Russia did well when it was in Russia. I think they got to the quarterfinals and got eliminated, I think, by Croatia at that point, which no shame in that. South Korea got to the semifinals, you know, when it was in South Korea back then. So the U.S., when it was here in 1994, I mean, we eliminated Colombia, which was one of the favorites to win the whole thing, and then barely lost to the eventual champion Brazil 1-0. So the home team, home field advantage matters. And we do have a cohort of players that are all right. You know, they can play and they can do some damage. But it's not a coincidence that those players didn't really play MLS, right? They're all Europe players. You know, Weston McKennie never played in MLS. He left. No, Christian Pulisic left. Weah never even played in the youth system here, really. He was gone. You just go down the list. Musa never played here. Go down the entire list. Anthony Robinson, you name it, Serginho Dest. They're not products of the American system. And so that is why we actually have the core of the team is non-American based, which is really quite telling in many regards, even though MLS has done its darndest to try to get some players this cycle and in anticipation of 2026, some players on that team that played in MLS, obviously for marketing reasons. I understand it's a business. I mean, I would do the same thing if I were in their shoes. Absolutely. But those players are turning out not to be centerpieces at all in challenging for a World Cup.
Well, this is getting into the youth game now, which is really, really my bread and butter. And so that's the question. You know, people think that we're making these huge advances in our youth game and that we're producing all these players, but the players that are currently, to your point, making the most significant contributions, they're not youth players. We don't have 16 and 17 year old kids on the national scene. Unless I'm missing somebody, Gary. All these players are in their mid-20s. They're in their prime. They did not, for the most part, come through our system, as you've just laid out very nicely. So, they always want to point to, you know, Calvin Sullivan or whatever, you know, from the Philadelphia Union. And that's, I hope that kid makes it. I hope he's awesome for Man City. I hope he's great. We should have 50 to 100 Calvin Sullivans. Like Argentina is selling $20 million teenagers to Europe every other week. Like this idea that we're turning some corner on youth development, I just don't see it. I really don't. Like yes, there are some nice success stories here and there, but when's the last time a 17-year-old played for the national team? I would say Pulisic. Two, 10 years ago. So, you know, when's the last time a 17-year-old played for Argentina? Last week. It's just that, you know, I know we're talking about coaching licensures, but it's all connected. I mean, it's all connected.
All of it is connected. There are a few exceptions, like you said, like a Tyler Adams, but even if you look at Tyler Adams, who is a stalwart on the men's national team, somebody that's important, he didn't stay here very long at all. He played maybe a couple years on the Red Bulls and shipped them off like right away to Europe. You don't stay here until you're 22, 23, 25 years of age, because then you're just going to be ruined. And that's just the truth. And, you know, I see the stories like, whatever his name is, Kevin Sullivan from Philly, that kid, the 16-year-old, 15-year-old kid. I don't want to be the cynical guy. It's just I just know, because I've been there. I've seen it. I've with my own eyes. In our country, they try to elevate players and make something happen for them. They pick particular players and they're not ready and they're not as good as the hype makes them seem at all, Rory, at all, but they try to force it. You know, they try to say, look, we have a phenom here who is in our system. Let's debut him on the first team MLS. Let's debut this one on the first team. Let's debut that one on the first team. And it really sucks for the kids, in my opinion, in certain regards, because you're kind of signaling to them some that there's something that they're not. And we all know the story of Freddie Adu as well. Freddie Adu is very, very talented. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, it reminds me of this Michael Jordan interview that he had a long time ago where he was, and everybody, the older generation always likes to crap on the younger generation. I get it, right? But he's like, hey, look, in my year, in my generation, we would get sponsorships from Nike or Adidas or anybody when we earned it and showed that we can play on the field already at the pro level.
In all honesty, it's, you get paid off of potential. A rock star, you have to be good. You know what I mean? You get paid off of potential in that sport.
Really? Yeah, because every game, it's about the potential.
Well, even then, if you come in now, most of our young kids come in now, we don't know how great they're going to be, but yet they got 5-year guaranteed, millions of dollars, admirations of many.
But don't you think that's partly because of you?
Partly interpreted totally wrong. And I would say that with
Straighten me out.
I will straighten you out, so we got problems.
Yeah, but let me say this one.
No, let him straighten me out first. Why?
See why? I mean, he dominates everything.
No, I want you to tell me why.
The reason is that when you look back in our era, you know, Michael Jordan, the Magic Johnsons, Larry Bird, Charles Barkley, we earn what we got. That means when the corporate people came back. I don't mean to demean the young kids because I think it's something that they have to learn, and hopefully they will learn that, is that when the corporate America came to us, we had a game that could validate their admiration and
sponsorship and all that,
Now they get that before they play one game.
Yeah.
So you're rolling the dice to see if this kid's ever going to be good or not.
Yeah.
So in essence, you're paying the kid off of potential that he may be great.
You don't think that's good?
No, because I think it sets bad work ethic. When you get something so easily, you're not going to work as hard.
You don't think so? Okay.
And nowadays, they're dishing out sponsorships to everybody and their mom. You know, they're doing name, image, and likeness in college already. They're throwing Nike sponsorship deals to 15 and 16-year-old youth national team players. And I get that the marketplace has maybe shifted with the role of social media and influencers. And maybe if they do this sort of stuff with the youth national team players, they get, you know, Nike might get a little bit of exposure, you know, and that with whatever audience that player happens to have, but it sends a poor signal to the players. And in many, and I've seen it, Lori, firsthand experience, it makes them think there's something that they're not. And then it trickles into their work ethic, their habits, their mentality, and it's rough sailing from there.
Yeah, I think it all goes back to, and I know that the, I guess, naysayers to any of these conversations are always like, oh, you're always blaming on lack of promotion relegation. You're always blaming it on that. Well, I mean, like, if you don't have a system set up to incentivize what happens on the field, what you're getting is a quality of something else. What you're getting is something that is inflated, that is maybe a political angle. There's something else happening, because if you're basing incentives on what happens on the field, is a pretty objective way of doing it. You win or you lose. And in general, if you're doing things the quote unquote right way. So if you're developing all these great youth players and you're in another club somewhere around the world, something good's probably happening for you economically, socially. You know, you're getting recognized, you're selling players, your coaches are getting recognized. A lot of good things are happening. It doesn't exist here. It just doesn't exist. Like, if you are the coach of this fantastic U16 team, and you are doing great things, there's a ceiling of what that gets you, what that gets your players. You know, it just isn't the same, because the economic environment and the ecosystem doesn't allow it. So every one of these conversations that we have, whether it be about coaches, coaching licenses, players, youth development. It just always goes back to this, that the system isn't set up to help those people, you know, rise to the top.
It's unfortunate. Are you going to do the B license after all? I know you kind of circumvented it and did the WEFA stuff, but are you going to still try to get in?
Yeah. I'm definitely going to do the B license, the USB at some point. I mean, technically I have my UEFA B license, so I can coach at the level that I aspire to coach in. But I think for completeness, I do want to do the USB license as well. I've had actually several of my friends who have gone through the UEFA B license also have done the USB. So, and it's interesting because a lot of them are doing it because they're in fear that if they don't have it and they only have the UEFA B, even though technically you should be fine, they're concerned that they might not get, this is more on like the college side of things, that they're worried they might not get a college job if they don't have the USB, like they wouldn't accept the UEFA B, which is again, really sad, but that's a lot of, but yeah, I think I eventually will get the USB, yeah.
How long does it take? Do you know off the top of your head? Is it like a 6 month long thing, like three in-person meetings?
Yeah, it's six months. And I believe it's two 5 to 7 day like events where you go and there's classroom work and then you have to, you know, run sessions for teams and stuff like that. And, you know, that's a whole other kind of point here. Most of the time when you get your license, when you run a session, like the session that you are using to pass the course or to do whatever, you don't actually get your team. You get a group of players you've never seen before. So that in and of itself is challenging. I mean, most of the time you do submit videos of you with your team, but when you actually go to whatever center it is and have the in-person meeting, they typically give you, like when I did my USC license, it was interesting. There were two groups of teams. There was, and all the coaches, we had 25, 30 coaches there. There were like literally two groups. So obviously these kids were dead by the end. One group was a U12 girls ODP team. And that's the group that I got. And they were awesome. Super attentive, super, you know, want to be helpful. They were great. And the other group was a group of U16 boys. I don't even know what they were, a club team or something. They looked like they didn't want to be there. And if you got that group, it was awful. Every single coach who got that group, they were not running. They were like, get me out of here. It was terrible. And I was just so thankful I had these U12 girl ODP team because they were super into it. But, you know, it gets to that point. It's like, if you're going to get a license for a course, you're going to be given a team you have no conception. I don't even know where to put players. I'm like asking the girls, who plays center back? Who plays wing? It's just, you know.
Good God. Good God, man. Did everybody pass? Do you know if everybody in your cohort passed or not? Do they fail people?
They do, yes. So it's interesting because you'll hear something different from sort of everybody. I've heard, you know, things where, you know, a lot of the UEFA people don't think the U.S. soccer fails people. And most of the time, at least, I would say at least, I mean, I can only really speak from the USC. When they fail you, there is a pathway after you fail to sort of get the license, like a makeup type of situation. And in the UEFA, they have a similar thing, but it tends to be a little bit harder. Like if you fail the UEFA class, it can be really tough without completely enrolling in the class again to just get it. And definitely my UEFA B license, they were failing people. I mean, they were very serious about that license. Like you really had to show, you know, cause I know at least in Europe, like if you have your UEFA B, like you're definitely eligible for some jobs that maybe, you know, you wouldn't be otherwise. As far as my USC, they did fail people. It was just, you know, I again, when you get into this situation, whether it be a US or UEFA class, like imagine, you know, and a lot of the times, believe it or not, I've had it where they don't have players. So the coaches are the players, which is even a harder situation. But you're put into a scenario where you've got 30 to 40 eyes on you, whether it be coaches, whether it be players, whether it be the instructors, and you have to deliver a session, whether it's 20 minutes, 60 minutes, whatever it is. Like, if you don't know your stuff, it's not that difficult to get weeded out. Like, it's just not. Like it's the spotlight is on you. And if you don't have your stuff together, it's not, you know, like the people who failed the courses I was in was not a big shock to me.
Got it. All right, man. No, I've gone on this educational kick most recently because, as you know, the education landscape is changing dramatically. I'm speaking education in general now. So sure. I think of things like engineering. Yeah. And, you know, back in the day, up until recently, you kind of had to go get your degree in engineering, maybe an advanced degree in engineering, get the credential. And that was the signal for employers. And nowadays, that's not necessarily true. You can just do stuff. So if you're a 12-year-old or a 15-year-old or 21-year-old or a 38-year-old, whatever the case may be, you can film yourself maybe on YouTube giving your own maybe lecture on robotics and then film yourself actually soldering components together and building a robot and, you know, talking. You can prove expertise without having to go through the traditional education system and absolutely get hired. And same thing with writing code. Just write your own code, upload it to GitHub, you know, open source it, and then that's your resume. And folks can evaluate you pretty straightforwardly, you know, how good you are, where you are on the bell curve. So that's like a modern day view of the education system, being able to prove yourself in the marketplace without having to spend and go into debt potentially to get a job later. And so with that lens, in addition to my experience in the soccer ecosystem, I'm like, why do these licenses exist? Do they actually have to exist or not? And hence why I wanted to talk to you, Rory. I think it's still required in medicine, in law, right? In construction, you don't want some rando kind of creating a building, your house, and it's going to fall on your head. You know what I mean? So I get all of those licensing requirements. It's just when it comes to like soccer coaching, like really, you have to have a license, you know, to coach at particular levels. It hits me the wrong way, man. That's all.
No, it's sort of, you know what? It sort of goes back to the point you made earlier about, you know, what you've been sort of advocating for so many years is like, show me what you can do. And, you know, I think that's in part what has been successful for me on the YouTube page, is that I'm actually showing what I'm doing. And then people go out and they try it and they're like, hey, this is okay. Like, this is actually something that works. Like, this is, because that was much my experience seeing Brian, you know, watching him coach, watching him go through rondos and pattern choreography and things like that. And I'm like, oh, that looks interesting. Let me try that with my teams. And I'm like, shit, this stuff works pretty good, you know? And so you kind of get into this, you know, scenario of kind of see somebody else do it, apply it yourself, get that positive reinforcement that it's worked. And that is the validation. It almost sounds like that's what you're describing with engineering.
Yeah, man. I don't know. Maybe I'm naive. I want to fix American soccer. Oh man. One day, maybe after I die, Rory.
I don't think you're the only one though. I tell you what, I'm encouraged every day. I get emails every day. I'm sure you do the same, where people say, hey, I really enjoy your content. I'm trying it with my team. It's working. And that stuff makes my day. Like when somebody sends me an email saying, hey, I was doing your battle boxes and I really liked it. I mean, so, you know, I think we've described this before. I mean, you can only control a certain circle of influence, right? And so, We're up against a beast is the problem. You're up against this massive, massive system and beast. And it just almost will take some kind of revolution by the people. I don't know what else would it will take. But I think you're seeing that now, not to go down another rabbit hole, but I don't know if you've been keyed into a lot of the MLS Apple stuff that's happening. There's a lot of discontent that's going on. I don't think that deal has worked out the way that they thought it was going to work out. So we'll see what happens there.
Yeah. And the other development, but I've heard it before. I want to see it to believe it with USL potentially, you know, obviously applying for Division I status, and who knows how that'll all go, because from my vantage point, U.S. soccer is basically being captured by MLS, you know, so why would MLS allow USL to also get Division One? And if USL does get Division One, obviously the next step, which I think they should do, is implement some form of promotion relegation, even though it's not the real thing. It's not a true open marketplace. But hopefully, I'm crossing my fingers, it's better than nothing, and then carves a step forward to maybe one day getting the real thing. Because look, if there was promotion relegation, even at the USL level, first division, second division, third division, then I don't know, man. I think the communities would get pumped for it. I think if you're a third division USL club, you will get pumped. The ownership will get pumped. The coaching staff will get pumped. The players will be pumped. The community will be pumped to, and the local business will be pumped to see that team go up the ladder potentially. And there will be a lot of excitement generated. I mean, those are definitely things that are above my pay grade, but it would be awesome, man. It would be awesome.
Oh, I think what you would see in that scenario, especially if it's a true open system, is you would see almost every semi-large to large youth club have a pro team. And then you would see breakthroughs. You would see somebody like, one of the bigger clubs in Philadelphia is called FC Delco. Now, you probably know that name. Like, you would see a club like that, and I'm just using them as an example, breakthrough to, you know, USL 3 or whatever it is. And then maybe you'd see them go to USL 2. You know what it would do to the families who had players in that club? I mean, I don't want to say they would stop following Philadelphia Union, but they would pay a heck of a lot of attention to that particular club, you know, and this would be everywhere because it would be an open system. And we already have all these clubs, several of them with very large budgets, like having the opportunity. And then you get the cultural buy-in, which we don't really have here. You know, and that propagates itself up to where I think MLS would be in big trouble. I think if, to your point, USL decided a true open system, let's go, anybody can get there. I think MLS could be in big trouble.
I think they'd be in big trouble as well, because that also would undermine all their plays to dominate the youth game with MLS Next and MLS Next 2, because all of a sudden all those families would be like, well, we don't really have to go and play MLS Next 2 or MLS Next for my kids. I'll just stay at my local USL club, who is either in the first tier, the second tier, the third tier. Even if it's in the third tier, it doesn't matter. There is a pathway to the professional team here, and then the sky's the limit. Like, we don't have to uproot ourselves and leave. So that whole play by MLS might go down the drain if USL were to play this move.
Oh, and then what if they added training compensation and solidarity payments? Now you're talking about having a completely transactional youth development system. So even if they were USL 3, they could just sell players to USL 1 teams and benefit from that. And now you've got everybody moving in the same developmental direction to make better players, better coaches, better clubs. I think MLS would be in big trouble.
So the referendum is out. Is U.S. soccer truly independent, or are they captured?
Right.
All right, man. I don't know any other lasting thoughts that we didn't cover on licenses. I think we did a pretty good job.
Yeah. No, any other questions that you can think of? I think I pretty much said everything that I can think of as far as the licensures go.
No, brilliant, man. I think this is going to be very helpful for a lot of folks out there. I always recommend to the coaches, even though they know my position on licenses, I'm like, hey, dude, just go and do your licenses, jump through the hoops. You know, you have no choice. Say yes, sir. Say no, sir. Say yes, ma'am. Say no, ma'am. Get your certificate and just move on from there. I know, because I get folks who tell me, hey, Gary, they really hate rondos at U.S. soccer. You know, and I'm like, hey, don't fight them. Just say, oh, you know what? I hate rondos too. And just lower your head and just do it.
No, that's so funny. I had my D license was like that. They did not appreciate anything that was, in their mind, not directional. Mm-hmm. So like I think I did a 4v1 rondo or something like that as like my warm up or my activation. I don't even remember. And I know I had an instructor tell me, well, that's not directional. And I'm like, what do you mean it's not directional? It's I could show you this exact, you know, action in almost every game that exists. So, the only other, now that I'm thinking about, the only other thing I do want to add, is that it's interesting that I don't think the licensures, now when the UEFA is different because it's really kind of leading down a pro pathway. So, and I've described before kind of the specifics of how some of those courses work, but a lot of the coaches who are going, let's just say, to the C level, like they're coaching the youth game. And I don't know that the target of a lot of that stuff is, you know, grassroots or youth focused. And there's a lot of issues that come up for coaches that aren't really even addressed. Like how many times do grassroots or youth coaches come to a training session expecting 12, but only 10 show up? Well, what do you do? Like what, you know, like, and I know what to do because I've done this so long, but if you're taking a course, that should be part of it. You know, like, yeah, like how do you deal with parents? How do you have a conversation with a parent? Like none of those things are part of the licensing course. Those are just things I learned going through it. And I think if we're going to really have a licensing course, like something that's going to teach you how to do the job, you got to add some of these things. Like it's got to be part of it. And I think the youth game in general is kind of neglected in that way in some of these licenses.
Yeah, there's a couple other things here I just jotted down. In addition to all this stuff, you can't teach passion or you can't teach empathy and you can't teach the level of engagement and you can't teach how a coach delivers the message to the players and you can't teach, identifying what players need what buttons pushed and what players don't need certain buttons pushed. And all of that is a huge, huge piece of the coaching puzzle, which kind of makes you makes or breaks you in many times, is whether you have that capability or you don't have it. And then the other thing I wanted to ask you, because it just came to mind, is do they, in these licenses, do they ever mention, what's their philosophy on sideline coaching? Do they ever mention it at all? Do they say, hey, just whip out the lawn chair, sit down, let the game, you know, you already trained them during the week. This is the testing ground. Let them do whatever they want to do. Or maybe give them some lessons or corrective actions, not during the game. Again, yeah. Well, what do they have to say about that, if anything?
So I would say I had two completely different experiences from the U.S. to the UEFA side. The UEFA side is very much interested in you having, you know, clear instructions and clear ideas. So like if you're going to have an overlap, why is that player overlapping? What are we doing? And they'll stop you every second. Say, what are you doing here? What are you doing there? Why is this? Why is that? It was just, you know, they didn't tell you necessarily you had to have this player move here and that, but they wanted your own ideas as to why you were doing what you were doing. And if you didn't have it, you were found out right away. The US side of things tends to give you kind of these tools. So they will say guided discovery is a tool and stop freeze is a tool. And, you know, I think if I'm remembering correctly from my C license class, there's like four or five different tools and they don't want you to like use too many of these tools. But again, they don't want you to stop it every 2 seconds. They want some guided discovery. They want a couple of freeze moments. They want a couple of, you know, coaching in the flow was another one, like where you would coach, you know, as it would go. But again, a lot of that is like, okay, like these are these broad general concepts, but you're not really telling me, okay, what do I need to do in this scenario? I mean, like the Scottish guys would say, listen, we're attacking in the wide area in a 4-2-3-1. Why is your center back this high? Like, why are you having, like, why didn't you tell that attacking center mid to underlap? Why'd you tell him to overlap? Why'd you tell him to play a 1-2 ball here? Why, like, you just got to like really specific soccer tactical scenarios. Whereas my US license just wasn't like that. I don't think that the Scottish, or at least my UEFA B license, were necessarily against, you know, anything. I mean, I think if you were freezing the practice every 2 seconds, they would tell you that. But it was really more about what the clear ideas are. I mean, they definitely make it a point of like, okay, where are you positioned as a coach in your training session? Both of the licenses did stuff like that. But as far as the US license, it's more like, here's some types of coaching you can do, and don't do too many of one thing. It was more nebulous, I guess.
But what about during a match, Rory? Because I mean, if you've heard Ryan coaching through the videos or whatever, he can be active, quite active during a match. And some people would call it joysticking here, but I think it's greatly exaggerated. You know, his interventions are quite rare, but he certainly is more active than your average bear, I would say, on the sidelines. So I know I don't want to taint your response. I don't think it will be, but I hear all the time that US soccer is vehemently opposed to being too active or active at all on the sidelines during a match.
Yeah, I think that they are generally against a lot of what you would call joysticking. And I think it depends a little bit on the age, in terms of that term, that joysticking term, because I do think it has a bad rap, definitely. I think for 8, 9, 10-year-olds, there is some value, and I will say some value, in this whole let them play thing. Like, I don't think you should be saying, pass it here, run here, do like there has to be clearly some, you know, of their own experimentation. But as you get older, and you know, there you have a U16 team. I mean, the instructions that I'm giving a U16 team are completely different than I'm giving a U10 team. I mean, you know, we have a specific game plan with specific coaching points, and we're trying to exploit possibly specific players on the other team. So, you know, if I'm telling them we're going to attack down the right side 95% of the time because their left wing and their left center back are weak, that's what they're going to do. And if they start going down the left side, I'm going to say, what the hell are you guys doing? Get the ball over to our right wing and let's go. I do think that that's been demonized, this whole idea of letting them play, number one, which I think is a total, you know, maybe that's a conversation for another time, but like I this whole let them play thing, I think, is a lot of times an excuse for coaches who don't want to give specific instructions. And then this whole idea of joysticking, I think I definitely, like, you know, because I was just in a tournament this weekend, I definitely saw, you know, my U11 team, I do try not to give them a ton of information as they currently are making decisions. And now if the ball goes out of bounds, I'll say, hey, listen, we could have switched the point of attack there. Like, what are we doing? Like, but I do think there's some age, you know, issues there. But in general, I do think US soccer is against joysticking. And they are specifically, you know, this let them play stuff, which I've never heard that in my UEFA classes, let them play. And you definitely don't hear that in Argentina. I mean, I think in Argentina, the stuff that I heard was even more like you do this right now, you know?
Yeah, no, a lot more engagement from the coach on the sidelines during matches. That's for damn sure. And even because folks have read articles here in the United States over the course of the years, especially during Barcelona's heyday, during Pep Guardiola's era, right? And La Masia's heyday. They're like, oh, well, look, Gary, in Barcelona, you know, they don't say anything. They just let the players play, sort of thing. And that couldn't be further from the truth. And I can tell you, because I was there and we played against them and we saw their academy teams playing competitive matches, and the coaches are up and pacing and left and right and speaking and engaging the full 90 minutes or whatever, however long the game lasts. And folks here also had the wrong impression about winning doesn't matter, sort of thing. And Barcelona doesn't care if they win or lose, because obviously Barcelona says that winning doesn't matter at the youth level. Yes, all true. It doesn't matter. They care about their first team and developing for the first team. But you best believe that if they are losing or they are drawing the game, the coaching sidelines are up in arms. There are flames all over the place. The world is coming to an end. And they get in big trouble if they happen to lose, you know, especially to their rival Espanyol. And to add to that, look, you're talking, forgive the tangent, but they were talking about one of the best academies or one of the best academies in the world. It's very rare that you lose anyway. You can literally not do anything, and most of the time you're going to win. So there's just a lot of these misconceptions when it comes to coaching on the sidelines. Sometimes, you know, I just recorded an episode with Benny on where he selected certain toxic comments that we get on YouTube or on Instagram, you know, and we kind of respond to them. And one of them was on this sideline coaching thing and U.S. soccer's view of it and obviously the mainstream. And, you know, I thought for a moment, maybe if I'm being charitable, there's some genius level thing going on in the background where they recognize maybe most or the vast majority of coaches here aren't that great in American soccer. And to prevent harm being done to the players, they just make this broad edict of, hey, you know what? Just don't coach them on the weekend because you'll do more harm than good. I don't know. That's me trying to be charitable at that point, but it's interesting. Did the UEFA guys, I don't know if you answered this, did the UEFA guys mention anything about being active during a match?
No, not really. I mean, there again were a lot of the stuff that I went through the UEFA pathway was really specific to a certain scenario that you're working on. So they wanted to know, like, okay, like, for example, if you're working on a particular concept, attacking in the wide area in a 4-3-3, and, you know, an error happened, something changed where, you know, they could have crossed the ball in, they didn't, or whatever. Like, you're supposed to stop it as a coach. And then they actually use these words, rewind, show them what they're supposed to do differently. So I know that's in the training session. From a coaching on the sideline standpoint, there wasn't a ton on that, to be fair. There is some stuff that you have to do as far as, you know, film yourself in a game, film yourself giving a halftime speech, things like that. But from a, like an actual, what are you supposed to do on the sidelines? There wasn't a ton.
Got it. I think you nailed it. If you've been clear with your players on the training grounds as to how we are going to play and they've been trained on it, precisely what the expectations are, I think it's perfectly fine for you to be on the sidelines during the match and taking some corrective actions or applauding them, you know, actively applauding them if they're executing what they've been trained on. So I don't know. Maybe it's that folks think that, I don't know. I'll just leave it there, man.
I think it really boils down to age. I know I said that before, but I think what they do, like when people think of sort of the worst case scenario, it's the U9 coach who's screaming the entire time, telling them exactly, pass it to the right, now run to the left, now do this. Now, and clearly that is a step too far and has, you know, it is counterproductive. But they take that particular example and then they apply it to everything and just saying, let the players play. Where that's not at all what most, I think, coaching licenses or coaches would agree with. Like, you don't just let the players play. There has to be some philosophy, some plan, some idea about what we're going to do, whether it's just in general how we play or whether it's specific to a specific match on the weekend versus a specific team.
Well said, man. I couldn't say it better myself. Tell people where to go, Rory. Your YouTube channel, what's its handle?
No, it's Coach Rory Soccer at YouTube. It's that I continue to be amazed at that page. It's almost up to 50,000 subscribers now. And really it's just, most of it is hopefully tangible content that people can use to coach their youth team. Some of it is me giving my opinions like I am now. So those can be interesting videos, but for the most part, it's really just technical and tactical videos for youth teams.
Awesome, dude. Hey, you're going to have to mentor me on how to get 50,000 followers. That's amazing. Incredible.
I told you when we started. I don't know how. I don't know either.
Yeah, I don't know YouTube algorithms.
But you know what? But part of the success, Gary, I think of 343 or my YouTube page, when you give people quality content that they can see and then they use it in their own environment and it works, you don't really have to sell anything. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have to sell the fact that I'm, quote, doing good work because people use it and then they tell me I'm doing good work. So I can't explain, but I do think when you actually produce content that people use and are valuable to them, they follow you.
I agree with you, man, but you do have some good thumbnails, I got to admit.
Yeah, that's true. You got to get used to the thumbnails. That's true.
Oh, last remark. I do think, you know, your last one probably gained a lot of traction. In my view, it seems like if you talk about the macro stuff, like that applies to everybody, there's just a bigger audience for it, you know, versus if, hey, what do you do going down the side, you know, the right channel, blah, 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 under these circumstances, and how do you get numbers up,
right,
versus, hey, Mauricio Pochettino said X, Y, and Z and didn't, and, you know, snubbed this player, and like that all of a sudden gets right. a bunch of traction.
No, one of my biggest videos was just me talking about going to Argentina and comparing and contrasting that, which a lot of people probably have interest in, versus, yeah, my specific 4v1 Rondo video. There's a smaller audience there who would be interested. So no, that I think that's a good point.
Okay, so maybe that's what I need to do. I need to start talking shit on the national team, and I'll grow my audience.
There you go. You know, with some of these guys, and they're good guys who do this on YouTube, man, it's a lot of work. Like every single game you got to comment on, every single roster release you got to comment on. I'm not sure I'm up for that, to be honest.
No thanks. I told Benny the other day, and it's like folks think I care so much about the engagement and all this. I really don't. I only want to spend my time on things that I'm actually interested in. Like, why am I going to go off into left field and just to grow a following and talk about things that I'm not motivated to talk about? But I'm glad for your success, Rory, man. Again, one of these days I want to visit you. You have a nice handmade grill that you made there, Argentinian style. You sent me a picture of it. Maybe if you don't mind, I'll post it as the thumbnail here for YouTube. Are you using it a lot now that it's springtime?
Yeah. I literally just made dinner on it. Yeah. It's awesome. It's fantastic. Well worth the money I paid for the guy to come out and build it. It's been awesome.
Awesome, brother. Tell your Argentinian wife, thank you for, letting me do this and taking you away from her for a couple hours.
No problem, man. She's super supportive of this stuff, and that's part of my success. So I appreciate it. No, it's always good chatting. Love to come back on. I owe a lot to you guys. And so I'm more than happy to come on anytime.
Brilliant. Thank you, Rory. Have a good night, man.
Hey, man. See you later.
Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches: you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers, everyone, and keep building.